If your knees check the weather before you do, time to check out Joint Relief Institute. Fast, FDA-approved pain relief covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Good morning, Steve Dales, Pet World on WGN. Talking with a veterinary cardiologist, Dr. Chris Brennan, based in Chicago. How are you this morning, Dr. Brennan?
I'm doing okay. How are you, Steve?
Well, you're doing okay. I'm doing okay, but heart disease occurs in dogs and cats much more than people may think about, in part because our animals are living longer than ever before. But heart disease, I think, is very different in dogs than it is in cats. So maybe we cover each of them separately. Let's take dogs first.
Yeah.
I'm not going alphabetically then, am I? But we'll
get to... that makes sense. It makes sense to work with dogs first. They're, I see a lot more dogs than I see cats. So, I mean, what do you want to know?
What do I want to know? So heart disease in dogs can be genetic, and there are certain breeds where heart disease occurs. And I'm asking like 12 questions at once. And there are a couple of types of heart disease, different than cats, that occur in dogs. So... can you talk about all of that?
Yeah, I can, for sure. So that certainly we it's maybe easiest to think about dogs as having what we call congenital heart disease, which is a heart disease that they're born with, and acquired heart disease, which is heart disease that they get as they age in life. Both, in pretty much all cases, dogs with heart disease probably do have some genetic predisposition to it, even if they develop it later in their life. When we think of the congenital guys, we think of it's usually our purebred dogs that get congenital heart disease. Things, French bulldogs, English bulldogs, golden retrievers are at a certain level of risk. And the kind of disease varies based on the species and size of or the breed and size of the dog.
I want to chime in there for a second and be sure to add if we're naming breeds. First of all, we won't cover them all, but I do want to make a point of mentioning, because it occurs so often, Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, which the breeders are doing a better job with, but still, as well as Dobermans as well.
Yeah. And those are sort of, those are both breeds of dogs that while they have a genetic predisposition to heart disease, their disease is often not noted until later in life, which is one reason why it is so difficult to catch disease in them and maybe breed around disease in them, because by the time the disease is noted, the dog may already have had a litter of puppies, and that's maybe no fault of anybody's. It's just the way that the world works. Dobermans in particular get a kind of disease called dilated cardiomyopathy, where the heart muscle gets really weak, and it's really tough. It's hard for us to manage sometimes when they do get it, but we have a good number of screening tests we can do for them prior to the development of the disease to maybe help us catch it sooner. But it's just hard. There's no one test that can give you an answer, including like a genetic test. These are multifactorial diseases.
What are some signs that your dog might be at the beginning stages of this?
Yeah, good question. It's difficult, and it depends on the given animal. I would say the most common signs of heart disease in dogs, like early heart disease, is going to be things like weakness, lethargy, exercise intolerance. You may recognize that those are all very nonspecific signs, and so they need a physical exam to figure it out. Things that your vet might find are things like a heart murmur or an arrhythmia or an abnormal heart sound. People often will say that coughing is a sign of heart disease, and plenty of dogs with heart disease do cough, but it's neither particularly what we say sensitive or specific. So it's not particularly useful in animals with heart disease. Lots of animals with heart disease are predisposed to get a cough for lots of other reasons. But if you've got a breed that you know may be at risk for heart disease, like those Cavaliers, like those Dobermans, you see some trouble breathing, you see some worsening cough, you see weakness, those kinds of things, and the absolute, maybe most extreme case, episodes of collapse. Those are all reasons why a dog might want to see a veterinarian and maybe even a cardiologist.
All right. So in the 2.5 minutes we have left in this segment, what can you do about it?
Yeah, great question. We first thing is diagnosing the disease, but we can manage heart disease pretty effectively in these guys. Usually the mainstays of treatment are a drug called vetmedin, which helps us to just sort of improve overall heart function of pump function of the heart, and a drug called Lasix, which helps us to remove fluid from around the lungs. If they don't yet have heart disease, there's not a heart failure, we should say, so clinical signs as a result of their heart disease, there's maybe not a lot of specific treatment, but some drugs, including that one vetmedin or pimobendin, that one might help to sort of slow progression of disease.
However, we're talking about slowing progression of disease. As you point out, it's all about quality of life. And ultimately, yes, these dogs aren't going to live maybe as long as they might have if they didn't have heart disease with today's technology.
Of course, yeah. And so, I mean, there are some interventional procedures that people are doing, especially in dogs like Cavaliers who have a leaky valve disease. We call it degenerative valve disease. Aside from those procedures, though, a lot of times once they're in heart failure, and this is a big if, a lot of these dogs don't ever go on to develop heart failure. But if they do get there, we say they have about a year left until we're unable to manage their clinical signs anymore. I should say about 50% of them make it to about a year. That's a better way of putting it.
How long?
How
long have you been practicing?
I have been practicing veterinary medicine for 5 years now. I've been a boarded cardiologist for the last year.
Okay, so for 5 years, I want to explain this because things are moving really fast in a good way in veterinary medicine. Can you do more? Do you know more than you did 5 years ago?
Oh, 100%. And even in the last few years, these procedures that I'm talking about that some people do in dogs with heart failure, we can't do it just yet at Premier, but there's a device that people can put in called a V-clamp, which helps to sort of clamp the valve together. There are people out there that are doing open heart surgery to completely repair valves in dogs. And these things are just getting more and more popular. Certainly, a lot of times the limiting factor might be the cost of these procedures. But hopefully with time and with practice, we're able to bring that down too.
And that's my final question before we break here. And that is, looking into the crystal ball, I know you have, are we going to be able to do more today in 5 years than we can do today?
Almost certainly, yes.
All right. I like that. But we've left something out, cats. And arguably, cats may be maybe not diagnosed, but may have heart disease even more than dogs do. And we'll talk about that. And we have good news for cat lovers. And we'll do that. We'll talk about it when we come back on WGN. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. He's a veterinary cardiologist, Dr. Chris Brennan, who is an expert when it comes to cardiology. Yeah, he's a specialist, and you're located in Chicago, Dr. Brennan, correct?
Yes, that is correct, right at a Premier Veterinary Group Chicago at Belmont and Milwaukee.
All right, so we talked about dogs. Let's talk about cats. Now, at one point in time, maybe before you were born, for all I know, cats commonly had what was called dilated cardiomyopathy.
Yeah.
But through an organization, which I happen to be on the board, the Every Cat Health Foundation, we have funded research that way back in the day, Dr. Paul Pion did. He discovered that cats were not getting the right amount of taurine, an amino acid that they cannot create on their own, in cat food. And now cats do get enough taurine. Be careful if you're creating your own food for cats, because that's, I'm guessing, where you do see dilated cardiomyopathy today. But the big problem is what's called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. There are some other diseases, but that's the real big one. It occurs very commonly. So can you talk about how you might know if your cat has that? Because often, because they're cats in part, there aren't signs or symptoms until things get really bad.
Yeah. And so before they develop signs or symptoms, it's really hard. Probably the most common thing your primary vet might hear is a heart murmur on a physical exam, which just means that blood is moving abnormally in the heart. Other than that, there's some breeds that may be predisposed, Sphinx cats, Maine Coons, Ragdolls, certain breeds that we have known genetic markers for, though, again, like with the Dobermans, it's not 100% if they have the genes. But the best thing you can do in terms of watching them is if they have signs of trouble breathing. So if they're breathing really heavily, if they're like open mouth breathing, almost like panting like a dog, stuff like that, those are all signs that a cat might have heart disease and should be evaluated by a veterinarian promptly. I guess I should note, coughing, dogs can cough. Cats almost never cough with heart disease. If your cat's coughing, that's probably a different problem. But otherwise, trouble breathing is really the main sign.
All right. And slowing down. But how can you tell that your cat often, how do you tell that the cat is slowing down? So here's the thing that I have been preaching for a long time. And now there's an even better reason for me to preach this. Cats need to see the veterinarian in my world twice a year. And especially senior cats, because unless you have a stethoscope in your kitchen, there is no way you can tell that there might be an irregularity in the cat's heart, which, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean heart disease, but it's an indication of at least a possibility, Dr. Brennan.
100%. Yeah, I agree 100%. The best way for you to know if your cat has even a hint of heart disease is to have them evaluated regularly by their primary veterinarian.
And it is incredibly common. New research by Dr. Josh Stern has indicated this. And you know what? Yay! There is now a drug available, and I'll let you talk about the drug, for non-clinical hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. But that means you have to catch it before the signs occur. Can you talk about that?
I can talk a little bit about it. We're doing a different thing in cats that have signs, but this is a drug called Felosin. It's currently being marketed for cats, the subclinical hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It is conditionally approved by the FDA. Whether or not it is, it reverses the disease or helps to slow the progression, I think still remains to be seen. And they're currently doing a sort of large, I would say, national study right now with the goal to get about 300 cats to look more into it. And so I'm excited to see what the results of that study show. I believe it's a once weekly pill that they're giving in cats with subclinical disease to hopefully slow the progression. There's a small trial out right now that suggests maybe it does something, but we're looking for more data.
Right. And for when I go see the researchers speak, so far so good, because even if it does some good, that's better than anything we've had to proactively treat heart disease in cats rather than reactively try to treat heart disease in cats. At least I think that's the case.
Yeah, it's good work that they're doing, I would say. My only concern about it, and it isn't really borne out yet, is I would want to make sure it's really, really, really safe, right? And there's not a ton of warning signs, so I wonder a little bit, just because we just haven't had a huge study like the one they're doing right now, so that'll definitely tell us. But if we're giving a medication to a cat who is otherwise healthy right now, we want to make sure we're not going to make them worse for any particular reason. And my concern more than anything and is that cats with HCM, a lot of them develop problems, but most of them don't. So many cats with HCM will go on to live completely normal lives. It's still a worthwhile endeavor, and we really want to try and capture those cats that don't get it. But we want to make sure if we're prescribing every cat with HCM this drug, even the ones that would never have gone on to develop problems, we're not going to give them any other problems in the future, too.
Of course. And so far, so good, as you point out with the study. Having said that, well, many cats, interestingly enough and happily, with HCM or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the heart disease we're talking about, live out a perfectly normal life and die of something else, maybe kidney disease at the age of 19 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Other cats throw like stroke-like events called thromboembolisms that get worse every time. It's really painful. It's expensive to treat. Also, heart disease, this kind of heart disease in cats, happens to be the number one cause of sudden death. So many times people don't even know their cat has heart disease, and then the cat just literally drops. So it is an impactful disease because all of this, while many cats do live out a perfectly normal life, many do not. And the disease is so incredibly common in adult cats of all ages, but especially as cats get older, Doctor.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And it's difficult. I will say I've always kind of wondered if some of these cats that die suddenly, if they really have heart disease or if something else is going on. It's an easy thing to blame, and it's probably right in a lot of cases. But every once in a while, you wonder, just because there's really no way to ever know unless you knew the cat had heart disease beforehand. But it's impactful, and lots of cats are affected. But that's another reason why we want to make sure anything we're giving to an otherwise asymptomatic cat really is not going to do any damage moving forward, because so many cats have it.
Well, one study out there, it's not a new study, but demonstrated via necropsies that, in fact, HCM was the number one, this heart disease, cause of that. Number two, by the way, feline heartworm. So protect your cats against heartworm. They can get it, too. Dr. Chris Brennan, thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for talking with us and helping educate us about heart disease in dogs and in cats. Thank you.
Of course. Have a good one. I appreciate it.
So there I was walking down the street with our dog who has since passed away. Her name was Hazel. This was not all that long ago, really, and about 2 years ago. And our dog was then maybe 15, 16 years old. And she's just sniffing at the grass. She's an older dog. She doesn't much care about much else, but she's enjoying herself sniffing at the grass. And there's a dog right next to us. And that dog is kind of doing the same thing. And I'm just standing there with the dog, and this lady is standing there with her dog. And then she turns to me and says, "Don't you want to pet my dog?" And I looked at the dog and looked back at her, and I said, "No, thank you." And she looked at me like she was really, really perturbed. But the dog was saying, "I don't really want to interact with this guy." All the dog was doing was pulling toward the other end of the leash, pointing its face in the other direction, no eye contact with me whatsoever, as if I wasn't there. And this dog was saying, "I don't really want to interact with this guy. I don't know why." This dog maybe wasn't good with strangers, and she wanted to encourage the dog to be better with strangers. Or maybe the way the dog was facing, which wasn't toward me, but the opposite direction, happened to be the direction the dog lived, and the dog wanted to go home for lunch. I have no idea why the dog didn't want to interact, but should it matter? And then I thought about something. I mean, we're taught, and I'm glad we are, if you don't know the dog, always ask, "Can I pet your dog?" And we teach our children that too, and that is all correct, but we forgot something. We forgot to ask the dog. Clearly, this dog was saying, "I don't want to interact with this guy, whoever he is." That's what this dog was saying. But either the woman whose dog it was didn't realize, or maybe didn't care. I don't know. But it made me think of something. We need to always, even our own dogs. So there you are sitting on the sofa, and you're petting your dog, and your dog struggles to get down, and you hold your dog tighter. Or maybe you call your dog up to the sofa and the dog doesn't want to go up there. And you literally put the dog up there and the dog jumps back down. And then you bring the dog back up and the dog wants to jump back down but can't because you're holding on to the dog. That dog is saying clearly, "I don't want to interact right now." Don't dogs have that right? But far more than that, I'm concerned about the dog bite numbers that are at record highs, actually. And there are a lot of reasons for it. But boy, oh boy, if we could better communicate and better understand what our dogs are saying, and incidentally, our dogs are always telling us something, then maybe dog bite numbers would be reduced. That's why I wrote the book, Ask the Dog, available on Amazon or wherever books are sold. He is a dog trainer, and may I say a rather outspoken dog trainer, but Zach George, who has a huge social media following, as he should, speaks his mind, and he's right here to speak his mind. Now, you said something, Zach, about the American Kennel Club that resonated with me. Can you explain what it is that you said, or say it again?
Well, the AKC, and thanks for having me on, Steve. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. The AKC is a deeply problematic organization. I know all of us may have heard about them in the past. The thing that got my attention about the AKC currently is how they are actively lobbying against legislation that would crack down on puppy mills, basically, you know. Now, I have views on that legislation, and I think it has issues as well, but we come at it from different perspectives. But the AKC, yeah, they're actively lobbying to protect puppy mills, and that's a problem, and just fits in a larger pattern of many problematic things that the AKC has been involved with.
And I want you to
get into if you want.
Yeah, I want you to. I want you to explain exactly what it is that you're talking about. And, you know, to be honest, I have experience with this as well, similarly, in that in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, no dogs or cats can be sold at pet stores. And I've been involved in supporting that notion and in other places around the country. The reason for that is where those animals are sourced, which is never, ever at a responsible breeder's home. They are always from either puppy mills or mass-produced facilities. In fact, no responsible breeder, I don't believe, Zach, would ever sell a dog to me completely sight unseen or without at least speaking to me. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, and I applaud you there. I really applaud you for being involved with supporting that. Specifically, what is it you're wanting me to answer there, though?
To comment on whether you agree or not with what I just said, and I guess you do, based on what
Absolutely.
So also explain how dogs and cats, and we're primarily talking dogs, at pet stores are not from responsible breeders. That's kind of where I'm going with this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the retail, putting dogs in retail establishments has been really problematic over the years and everything, because what they're doing is they're mass producing these dogs. They're putting them in living conditions that are inhumane a lot of times from these puppy mills. And of course, you know, the AKC is also very problematic because of the way they've commodified genetics of dogs. I mean, the breed standards prioritize extreme arbitrary aesthetics a lot over biological health. You know, we can think about Frenchies or the sloped back of the German Shepherd dog, for example. They don't have animal welfare in their best interest. What they have in their best, or what they're really fighting for, is their bottom line right now, because the more puppies that are sold out there and registered with AKC, the more money they make. And so that's why they appear to be against this.
All right. So let's talk about what puppy mills are and what AKC's position in this legislation is. And yeah, time permitting, I do want to talk about exactly what you just spoke about, and that is that they're more interested in the way apparently the dog looks rather than the health of the dog. But before that, let's talk about this.
Sure.
So what is the legislation about?
So as far as I understand it, this is legislation that basically is designed to crack down on commercial puppy mills because, I mean, of the issues we've just talked about. And, you know, AKC, they have this reputation, for some who may not know, that they market themselves as champions of dogs. But their legislative arm, the AKC PAC, is what lobbies against a number of laws, not just this one that's going out. And they frame it as protecting breeder rights from government overreach. But the reality is purely financial. I mean, their revenue depends on sheer volume. And it's important, I think, for everyday people and your listeners to really understand how problematic, really, the organization is. And, you know, we should make sure that we're not inadvertently supporting them. I mean, people like you, you're very prominent in the animal behavior field. You know, it's important that professionals like us continue to speak up when private interests come to our field attempting to exploit these animals or attempting to enable practices that would exploit them.
Are puppy mills what people think they are?
Well, I don't know what everyone thinks puppy mills are, but generally they have an emphasis on mass production of puppies and minimal or not enough interest in keeping those dogs healthy and in the proper living conditions, because it's, you know, very difficult when you have a lot of dogs.
And the legislation you're talking about, it's one thing that's bipartisan, actually. You know, it seems the Democrats, right, and Republicans are both saying, okay, this makes sense. And the AKC, to my knowledge, and it's what you talked about, is saying, whoa, wait a minute. Do you see any point at all in what the American Kennel Club is saying?
Well, I don't agree with, my first instinct from what I know about this current legislation out there is I don't completely support it either, but it's for a completely different reason. See, basically the legislation right now, basically says, look, the USDA can't enforce these overrun puppy mills. So we're going to hand over, authority to the Department of Justice. Now, I think growing the police state is not the answer either. I think addressing the underlying cause in the system would serve everyone better. I mean, right now the system is such that if you're at the USDA, a lot of those positions are appointed from or occupied by industry insiders and people who have special interests at heart and not the welfare of animals. So to me, I think the system needs fixing, and I don't think we need to expand the police state to, you know, inadvertently punish people or punish small businesses. But you're right in that it is a bipartisan issue. I come at these issues from a decolonial perspective very often, so I'm often very skeptical of a lot of the legislation out there.
Well, and I'm not so sure that this is the right way to do it either. But here is my argument, what it's always been. U.S. Department of Agriculture is about agriculture. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I don't know, 75 years ago or something, it was true that dogs were mostly outdoors or whatever. But now they share our beds. So I'm not sure. I mean, cows rarely share our beds. You know, dogs are not an agricultural commodity. So I've always said this is the wrong way to do it. This is the wrong government office to look at this. Now, I'm not so sure they've got it right yet. I would agree with you, but I don't think the Department of Agriculture is right either. We'll talk more about this when we come back with a guy who always speaks his mind, dog trainer Zach George on WGN. Zach George is here on WGN. He's a dog trainer, but you can follow Zach in social media just about anywhere. I think you can look out your window wherever you live and somehow see him. I got you last week in my toaster oven. You're everywhere, Zach. How can people find you?
They can always check me out on YouTube or Instagram or Facebook. Just look me up, Zach George. I'm easy to find.
Yeah, he is easy to find, and he states his opinion about all sorts of different topics. Zach has been on the show before, as we both agree, and we're hardly alone, Zach, but on you know what I'm about to talk about, and that is shock collars and aversive or punishment-based training methods, which has become more of a thing again as far as training dogs. And I don't know that you've heard or not, but I've had veterinary behaviorists on this show and other unquestionable experts that have said, yes, that's not the way to do it. And here's why, expert after expert. But nevertheless, it's frustrating because I don't know how many times we can say this, but I think part of the problem, Zach, is that people are frustrated. They try to do something. They try to do something else, and it doesn't seem to work. So then they turn to a method that kind of sells them on TikTok or on Instagram. Is that what you've observed?
Oh, that's partially what I've observed. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a multifaceted issue. I think there's a number of reasons that people insist on using outdated methods. You know, my criticism is limited to professionals, of course, not everyday folks. But I expect I have a high bar for anyone who's charging public from the charging the public money to train their dogs, and I expect them to really know what they're talking about and be able to train dogs without shocking the public's dogs' necks or yanking them around by the neck and calling it behavior modification. You know, it's also kind of related to what we were talking about with the AKC, how they continued to have institutional cowardice on training tools. You know, they refused to associate with any legislation that would ban shock collars or crack down on them, you know, hiding behind guardian rights in order to protect this traditional compulsion-based training out there. So, you know, I think a lot of it is our system as well that we live in. I mean, we live in a system that normalizes domination of those we view as weaker. A lot of that is just built into our way of thinking as a society, and I think that needs to be deconstructed by many of us in order for us to truly move on.
But I've got the solution. If you are frustrated, okay, and you tell me if you agree, and you may not, I've got the solution, I think. If you are frustrated and your dog is reactive to other dogs or whatever, and you say, I need a shock collar for whatever the reason, and you have a dog behavior issue as a result, I know what to do. And that is contact a veterinary behaviorist, because that veterinary behaviorist has more tools at his or her disposal than your average dog trainer. It may be a medical condition. After all, they're a veterinarian, that may play into whatever's going on anyway. They can provide medication, and when the time comes, they can refer you to a trainer that they are working with to help your dog. Do you agree with that?
of course I agree with that. And I wish more professional dog trainers were able to put their ego on the back burner and be able to tell that to people. It's really important to refer things out like that, that are complex situations. I actually just did a short form video on social media talking about how so much of reactivity is actually linked with physical pain or a health issue. So I'm really glad you brought that up. And so, you know, typically with these outdated training methods, their primary method is go and yank the dog around by the neck when they have an outburst. I mean, let's just call a spade, that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's not really addressing anything that's underlying. Of course, it's not addressing any physical pain that the dog may experiencing, and consequently makes it worse. So it's really important we get the word out here, because the public often confuses a shut down dog with an obedient dog. And there are many cultural reasons I think we look at dogs that way, as I mentioned before, but we really have to change that image. A shut down dog is just that, not a happy dog.
I'm trying to get the words right in my mind. Brachiocephalic airway obstruction syndrome. I think that's right. You mentioned the slope back on the German Shepherd dogs. In Europe, they're comparable to the American Kennel Club, says, no, none of this, this is not acceptable anymore. Also, docking dogs' tails, pinning the ears, all of these things, are they outdated? Do you think that these things that I'm talking about need to be paid more attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the United States is very far behind much of the rest of the world when it comes to these matters. You know, and dogs use their tails for a variety of things, communication, for example, and when we dock their tails, we're hindering on that. You know, cropping their ears is purely cosmetic, as far as I understand. There's not a medical reason. If there is, I am certainly open to hearing that, but and I'm not a veterinarian, of course. But yeah, I mean, these are things that we need to upgrade in our society, and it's up to us professionals to help the public understand those things rather than letting the inertia of tradition continue.
But I just want to make a point of this. In Europe, I know that they are saying, no more. I mean, we want to be up to date on these things. And it seems the American Kennel Club, and I don't really want to dump on the American Kennel Club. That's not my point in this anyway. But the reality is the reality, and they are either ignoring or in many cases supporting and promoting some of these things.
Absolutely. Yeah. They are the problem. I mean, they're a huge problem. I'll jump on them. I mean, they've been a problematic organization for quite a long time. They value some of the worst traditions in animal behavior. And basically, they just don't want their bottom line affected. I mean, when an institution's entire financial model relies on the commodification and mass registration of an animal, they will always protect their profit margins over the animal's welfare. And that is fundamentally what's wrong. When people come into our space, Steve, you and me, where we're trying to change the space and make it better, and they try and keep these toxic ideas around in our space, we must push back against that.
And you indeed are doing that. Now, how can, people may wonder, I read about or see Zach do this pushback and talk about a variety of other topics. Again, how can people find you?
Oh, social media, Instagram, YouTube. Those are kind of my bigger places where I hang out on the internet and express my views and try and make people more aware of a lot of these things.
And
so,
you do.
Yeah, YouTube.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
You do. Thank you, Zach. Keep speaking out. But you know what? I don't think you need to hear me say that. I have a hunch you would do that anyway. Zach George, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for everything you do, Steve.
Oh, no, you missed a radio show. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking with Dr. Ernie Ward. He is the founder and president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, which, what kind of organization is that? It's important because at least half our dogs and cats are overweight or obese. The number is actually over half. So we talked to Dr. Ward about it. If you missed that conversation, you can simply go to WGNradio.com, click on podcast, and look for Steve Dale's Pet World, and you can go back and listen. Or our conversation with superstar Scott Simon, who's in the Radio Hall of Fame, Scott Simon, your name sounds familiar. He's on NPR. He's a contributor to CBS News Sunday Morning, and he wrote a book about pets, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known. It was an entertaining conversation. Again, listen to the podcast, WGNRadio.com, or listen next week, bright and early, on WGN.